In 1989, police in Vancouver were hunting a serial killer, a rapist and murderer of children. Their investigation wouldn't only catch a monster, but it would also uncover a detailed journal and graphic photographs recording the killer's depraved acts. This evidence would point to the evolution of a violent, relentless sexual predator. Join me today for the horrifying case of Wesley Allen Dodd. I'm Emma Kenny, welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Now, as you know, guys, I don't expect that you need a trigger warning for my content, because the reality is that all of the content that I cover is going to be triggering on some level, and rightfully so. We talk about people getting murdered, we talk about horrible sexual violations and so on and so forth, but today, Wesley Allen Dodd has actually taken the biscuit, and I do feel like I need to give you the heads up that we're talking about child murder and child SA. So at the end of the day, this is going to be difficult. That said, there is something profoundly interesting about this particular individual because he doesn't fit the normal stereotypes that we would expect to see in these cases. And that's why I'm covering him. You guys obviously have been in touch and asked me to look at this case. And sometimes I look at the cases and think, what more can I talk about with an individual? But with this one, yeah, we have a lot to unpack and a lot to digest. So we get to the 4th of September, 1989. And it's harrowing. The bodies of 11-year-old brothers. And I say that because as a mother, we love our children. Any parents out there, we love our children. The idea that a predator could take two of your children, it is unfathomable. It really is. So the bodies of 11-year-old Cole Near and 10-year-old Billy Near are discovered. They're discovered by a man. He's just walking in David Douglas Park in Vancouver, Washington. They had found the boys' bikes nearby because they'd been abandoned. But then when they turn up the bodies, they note straight away that they've been killed by multiple stab wounds. Also, it was pretty clear from the get-go that one of them had been sexually assaulted, because whilst Billy was found fully clothed, Cole's pants had been pulled down. Police are quickly on the scene. This is absolutely harrowing. These are two little boys, two brothers. They find Cole, who's already dead. But Billy survives just a little bit longer. He dies en route to the hospital, but he's not actually able to engage with the police officers on that journey, so they can't get any information out of him. The murder investigation is immediately launched. This is a double homicide. But the problem that the police have is that there's very little to go on because the only witnesses were dead. The community was in absolute shock. Violent crime, like a double murder, it doesn't happen often anyway. It's a very rare occurrence, but for both victims to be children, to be brothers, absolutely unthinkable to imagine that a single family lost two children in that traumatic way. But this wouldn't be the end of these killings, because Vancouver's about to be rocked again. We get to the 1st of November, 1989, that is just 1 month later. The naked body of a little boy is discovered near the Vancouver Lake. Pheasant hunter finds it whilst he's out, and he notices something unusual around bin bags that seem to have been thrown in bushes, and realises after closer inspection that he's actually looking at a human body. The victim was 4-year-old Lee Isley of Portland, just discarded like rubbish. 3 days earlier, tragically, his father had allowed Lee and his older brother, who was 9 at the time, his older brother was called Justin, and he and Lee had gone out to just play in the park. Obviously, with Lee being younger, it was one of those calls the father had to make, but because his older brother was playing with friends there, he allowed him to go. And that must haunt that poor man. It must have infected every waking second of every moment of his existence from that day on. Because during that period of time where Justin and Lee are playing in the park, as is so normal with older siblings, you know, they're getting on with the things that they're doing, they're playing with the friends, they're not really that considerate or bothered about a younger brother because at the end of the day, they're in their own world being a kid. So Lee gets separated from Justin and the other kids, so he ends up playing alone on the swings and just vanishes. He's reported missing that same day. When they examine this poor child's body, they discovered that Lee had been suffocated, and they also noted that, as with Colnia, he'd also been sexually abused. So we've now got some really scary goings on in this area where children are being murdered. And I think that anybody who hears about these kind of crimes in an area that those crimes were occurring can't help but worry if their child will be next. It really does change the foundation of security and vulnerability within an area, and it makes you really consider whether you can even trust the neighbours around you. It changes the landscape of experience where you live, and it also changes the trust that you have in the world around you, full stop. Anybody could be responsible for these crimes. Understandably, the authorities are horrified by children's bodies turning up in this way. So members of the Clark County Sheriff's Office, Vancouver Police and Portland Police form a task force to investigate the case. They then take time to speak to lots of potential witnesses who believe that they had seen Lee with someone. But the descriptions are really vague, and the descriptions were also conflicting, so it's not turning up a particular individual that they're identifying. Now, on the 13th of November 1989, the police receive a call from New Liberty Theatre in Camas, Vancouver. This is because an adult male has tried to abduct a six-year-old James Kirk from the cinema. From the cinema. In plain sight. Let that sink in plain sight. So James had gone to watch Honey, I Shrunk the Kids with his mum and with his mum's boyfriend. He'd gone to the toilet on his own, and during him going to the toilet, a man approaches him and basically tells him to go with him. Now, James resists. And when he resists, the way that this guy responds to him is to punch him in the stomach, and then he carries him out of the toilets. But in spite of this little six-year-old child clearly being terrified and injured at this point, he fights back. I mean, he fights like hell, and he's so clever. He's screaming at the top of his lung, "Help, he's killing me." So he's literally using the right kind of language where it's alerting people to see this crime that seems to be played out in front of people. He's kicking, he's struggling, and the staff at the cinema, they realize that something very strange is occurring out here, so they follow the guy outside, and James is still screaming, he's still struggling, and at this point the man's panicked. So he drops the child, and then he runs to a yellow car, and he drives away at speed. I mean, this has happened in less than a minute, essentially, but the gravity of this situation and the reality that these staff workers are experiencing, seeing something so out of the ordinary, and then watching this child be dropped as this man just leaves the scene, and then it kind of sinking in that the staff have just witnessed a potential abduction at that moment. Now, obviously, James's mum and her boyfriend, they've heard the screaming. They don't know where their child is. They run into the lobby and they see James running back through the cinema doors. He's hysterical. And James explains straight away that this man has punched him in the stomach. So the cinema staff who'd been watching, they said that they'd actually watched, and they had clearly understood that this wasn't just a man assaulting this child. It was a man trying to abduct James. It actually makes me feel nervous even saying this to you, because we all know that if James hadn't acted that way, if the staff hadn't followed, if anything had occurred differently in that scenario, we would probably be talking about another death. And just how close did that little boy come to meeting his doom that day? Now, understandably, James's mother and her boyfriend are beyond shocked. And ironically, the boyfriend, who's 33-year-old William Ray Graves, he's like, "I'm not having this. I'm not accepting what's just played out." Yeah, he's relieved that the child is safe, but he wants to know who the hell has just tried to abduct the child. So the staff describe that it's a man. He's got dark hair. He's got a moustache. They said that he was wearing black clothes and they noted that he'd been driving this yellow car. And William's like, I'm going after him. So many of us right now are with William, aren't we? We're like, damn straight, you take my child, even if it's not my biological child, but the child that I'm in care of, you try to harm them, I'm going to come for you. I'm going to hunt you down. And William has that mindset. So William gets in his car and he starts searching. And he actually speaks to a guy in a truck who says that he'd seen a yellow Ford Pinto, which had basically driven away at speed. So William just randomly starts driving. He doesn't know where he's going. He has no idea where that car could be. He drives for about 4 blocks and then he spots the car. He notices that this car seems to be traveling really slowly. It's clearly got engine trouble. It's barely moving. And he sees that the driver matched the description that he'd been told about from the staff at the cinema. So we now have this, one could say vigilante behaviour, one could say completely understandable behaviour when a child had just been violently assaulted and an abduction had nearly taken place. But William's gonna deal with this on his terms. So he parks up, he walks over, and he uses a ruse. He asks if he could help. You know, he suggests that he could maybe help him with the car trouble. So the man pulls over, gets out, and he lifts the bonnet. William taps the man on the shoulder, grabbed his arms and asked him, why did you hit that kid in the theatre? I think that William shows an amazing amount of restraint, and I think he's quite righteous and just in the way that he acts, because a lot of us would just want to beat this person up, you know? You'd be so angry and you'd believe this is the person who's done it and you just want to take a few digs before law enforcement arrived. But William knows he can't be absolutely 100% sure that it is the right person, so he thinks he's not going to hit him. Instead, he whips him around and he gets him in a chokehold, and he says that he's going to detain him and that they're going to go to the police. But he does say to him, if you try to get away, I'll snap your neck. I like William a lot. The world needs more Williams. That's all I'm saying. So then he walks him all the way back to the cinema, all the way in a chokehold. At this point, he sits him on the ground. He binds his hands behind his back with a belt and he waits for the police. Now William, in spite of this incredible heroic action, couldn't have imagined for 1 second who he'd just apprehended. Nor, more importantly, how many lives he probably saved in doing so. The Camas police turn up very quickly and they arrest him on the spot, and then they bring him in for questioning, and then able to soon identify this particular man as 28-year-old Wesley Allen Dodd. There is something that the police officers connect almost immediately. They notice that James Kirk, this little boy, this child who was nearly abducted, has this really strong resemblance to the boy murdered in Portland, 4-year-old Lee Isley. So instantly, they connect Portland police because they want to speak to the investigation team. And they say at that point that we believe these two cases could be linked. And that's really good policing. We often know that things don't get linked and people don't make connections. But right from the get-go, it just triggered something with these officers. So Dodd's interviewed by Portland detectives at Camas Police Station, and he later gets transferred to Clark County Jail in Vancouver, where he gets questioned further. Of course, he initially denies having anything to do with the murder of Lee Isley or Billy in Colnir. He says it's got nothing to do with me. But during the course of the investigation that followed, detectives start to look at Dodd's past. And it is striking, because what they discover is an evolution of a sexual predator, a really, really sinister, malevolent, terrifying, and perpetual sexual predator. Let's look at what formed this man. I say man. I use the term very, very loosely. Dodd was born on the 3rd of July 1961 in a small farm town of Toppenish, Washington. He was the eldest of 3 siblings. He had a younger brother, Gregory, and an older sister, Catherine. His parents were Jim and Carol Dodd. And his father worked. He drove a dairy truck. But one of the things that I think he would have struggled with as a child was the fact that he moved around a huge amount of time. They, as a family, often relocated, and he disliked that. You know, he often spent less than a year in the same school. And we know that that causes an inconsistency in your childhood experience, but also it means that you can't really form great relationships with people because you're never there long enough for them to come to fruition. Now, Dodd absolutely denies that he was ever physically or sexually abused. He said he wasn't neglected when he was a child. And we can tell from research that many child sex offenders have actually been abused as children, but he doesn't have this mark, which doesn't apply to him. And the thing that he did complain about was the fact that he said his parents never told him that they loved him as a child. He said there was very little affection. And his sister actually supported these sentiments. She said, "We were never beaten. We had food and clothes, but there was just no family, no love." And we can all agree, it's really important that our primary caregivers let us know how they feel about us, because often children don't have the capacity to critically analyse their scenario emotionally, even if you are presented with actions that suggest that you're loved. Unless somebody's directly telling you, it still leads you to have the opportunity to question that. So that would be difficult. Now, one report down the line that did claim that Dodd did have some experiences that were less than perfect at home. The diary that he wrote, for example, said that he was physically and emotionally abused by his father. It also noted that his mum and dad would have really violent fights in front of him and in front of his siblings. And there's one entry that says on the 3rd of July 1976, that's on Dodd's 15th birthday, his father actually attempted suicide after an argument with his wife. So that in itself is highly traumatic. Also, Dodd allegedly, in these extracts, claimed that he was neglected in favour of his younger siblings. We all know about sibling rivalry, though, and we can all agree that as a teenager, a lot of us may have felt that our parents were not giving us the attention that we so deserved. Usually because we're quite disagreeable at that age and our younger siblings are nicer than us. But you know what I mean? It's not unusual that parents seem to be favouring other siblings when actually it's just you're interpreting the scenario incorrectly. Now, how much of this is all true, we don't know, because he might have been trying to garner sympathy, and I don't know, these kind of human predators stroke serial killers do tend to have a penchant and pinch of being massively manipulative and also pathologically liars. Anyway, according to Dodd, one of the things that was very present for him in his childhood was his sexual attraction to other children. He said at 9 years of age, he was attracted to other kids. And whilst we can say that many of us may have had the rumblings of liking children, we're not talking about it being in that kind of innocent context. We're talking about him starting to have really malevolent feelings around sexual desires towards other kids and what he wants to do with them. And what he does from that age onwards, well, soon it becomes chillingly clear to police, because he's going to have actually recorded all of this. So at school, he was a loner, and this wasn't helped because, as I've mentioned, he was always moving around. His brother described him as a nerd and somebody who wasn't popular. He said that other kids would make fun of him. So that's an isolating and abandoning experience, certainly for him, and could also provoke a level of rage towards other children because he wasn't involved, he wasn't included. He wasn't involved in any social groups and literally was said to have no friends. And it's as if this also incentivized him to escape more into his head and to start playing out in his mind these very dark sexual fantasies, these twisted ideas of how to gratify himself sexually. Now, as he matures, these fantasies, well, they become more and more violent, and they start to become not just about sexual motivation and what he wants to do in a sexual way. They start to form around violence towards hurting children, raping children, killing children. So Dodd later stated, "The more I thought about it, the more exciting the idea of a murder sounded. I planned many ways to kill a boy." Another thing that happens to him during his teenage years is that his parents ultimately separate, but Dodd says that the divorce wasn't hard on him. We get to 1976. This is when Dodd is 15 years of age. And from this point on, I guarantee all of you will be just going, "How? How did this? What? Why is she telling me more of this? And nobody's doing what? How is this carrying on?" That's how it's going to be for you. Believe me, it's how it is for me. So he gets arrested, 15 years of age, indecently exposing himself. Police take him in and they're like, oh, we're just gonna let him go. Just gonna recommend some juvenile counselling. Recommend, the word recommend should never be introduced to a sentence where somebody has indecently exposed themselves to anybody. It should be, you are going to counselling, full stop. And if you don't, there will be harsh consequences. But no, so he gets caught and he's kind of not even given a slap on the wrist. It's just allowed to be gone. He then manages to graduate from Richland High School. This is in 1979. But then, when he's 20, this is August 1981, he tries to abduct two girls. Now, abduction is a huge crime. We can all agree on that. And this man tries to abduct two girls. They very, very correctly report him to the police. And the police are like, we're not going to take any action. He tried to abduct two girls. No action's taken at all. How is this possible? You know, this is really serious criminal activity and he's not taken seriously. So this, by the way, is just a constant pattern in Dodd's offending behaviour. So he rarely gets punished for his many offences, and that means that his confidence is growing and his increase in his arrogance that he can get away with these kind of crimes is growing. And that means that the offending itself, the nature of the type of offences, are becoming more serious. Now, in spite of these horrific acts already, somehow he manages to get enlisted in the US Navy because they're unaware of these juvenile offences, otherwise he wouldn't have been given the opportunity. At this point, he's assigned to the submarine division that's stationed at Wagner Naval Base in Washington. On one occasion, he actually offers to pay a group of young boys $50 each to play strip poker. Now, he gets caught and he gets arrested. But incredibly, he just slips through the net again. They don't take any further action. They conclude that because he actually hadn't touched the boys, he hadn't committed an offence. Now, this is bad enough that I'm having to say this when we're talking about underage children being paid to take their clothes off, clearly for the sexual gratification of a man who's meant to be in the forces. That in itself is harrowing, but the fact that they don't believe that that's sexual is bizarre to me, and that he doesn't therefore get this taken any further. But the other thing is, he actually admitted to the police when he was questioned that he planned to molest the boys. But for some bizarre reason, as I've said, they conclude that no offence has been committed. This is despite the fact that he's actually confessed to the police that he wanted to molest the boys. So if he'd been left in that situation, he would have molested them. But they just let him go. And this reinforces his confidence. He's not afraid of the slap on the wrist repercussions that he's experiencing. Now, he does later down the line get arrested again. This time he's actually involved in sexual contact with a child. And he's then dishonourably discharged. You know what his punishment is for sexually molesting a minor? 19 days in jail. You get longer for stealing a sandwich from Tesco on occasions. Seriously? What was going on? He also is told he has to undergo counselling, but this does not feel an appropriate level punishment. So after Dodd is dishonourably discharged, he's arrested numerous times over the following years for sex offences. And bear this in mind, crimes that are actually reported and successfully prosecuted are the tip of the iceberg. They're the ones that, like I said, are reported. The vast majority of crimes against children are not reported. This means that he was without doubt, by this point, a prolific sex offender. In May 1984, Dodd gets arrested for molesting a 10-year-old boy. Now, he initially receives a 10-year sentence. This is later commuted to just 4 months. 4 months. And they let him go because they say, you know, as long as you attend counselling, we believe that you'll be safe. Apparently the court were completely unaware of his previous offences because I don't know. People are useless at sharing information and apparently children's lives are not that important. Also, one of the big reasons that he was released on these terms was that Dodd made a good impression on the judge. the judge was like, I mean, he's got a huge list of potentially life-threatening offences against kids, but I like the guy. I like the guy. Just say, have a bit of counselling. You'll be fine. Then we get to 1987. At this point, he's arrested in Seattle, and the reason he's arrested is he's tried to lure this 8-year-old boy into a vacant building. And he later admits that the whole purpose of that was that he wanted to rape and murder that child. Fortunately, that little 8-year-old felt that something was off, there was something not right. So the boy says that he wants to go and collect his toys first, and instead he runs home. At this point, he tells his caregivers and the police are notified. Initially, he's charged with attempted kidnapping, but those charges get reduced to attempted indecent liberties. This is due to the fact that he actually hadn't touched the boy or exposed himself to him. To be fair, I think with the list and history that we have right now, somebody should be carting this individual away and, I don't know, making them disappear from public eye forever. Anyway, the prosecutors at this point are aware of Dodd's history of sexual offences, so they recommend 5 years in prison. Pre-sentence report even says that as far as they were concerned, he is a threat to the community. Bit of an understatement there, but we can agree on a very light level, he is a threat to the community. But he's released after serving just 118 days in jail. And all he has to do is to promise to return to treatment. Yeah, just make a promise. You're a massive prolific child sex offender. But we feel like we can trust you. You should be able to trust me. I mean, there's very few actions I've got involved in that suggest that I'm, I don't know, a massive predator who lie their way out of anything to get what they want. I don't know, manipulate kids to go with me when really all I want to do is intend them harm. Yeah, you don't sound like you're a problem at all. I'm not. What are your terms? Maybe go to some counselling? Not a problem. I'll absolutely go. Forever. He didn't. He returned to treatment for a very small amount of time and within a year was out of it, even though he was advised to continue. Clearly has a great deal of respect for the authorities. I mean, he must have been laughing at them, wasn't he? He must have thought that they were absolute fools. So instead of carrying on with his treatment plan, he moves to Vancouver and he ends up getting work as a shipping clerk. Now let's get back to 1989. So Dodd at this point is held on suspicion of the murder of 3 children. Aware of Dodd's previous history as well, detectives are absolutely convinced that they've got the guy. They interrogate him for 3 days. And at this point, Dodd finally admits that he's responsible. He tells the police that they'd even find incriminating evidence in his apartment. So they rush off, get a search warrant, and the officers go to the apartment. And I can tell you now that not in their wildest nightmares could they ever have imagined what they were going to walk into, what they were going to find in that apartment. So immediately the police tell that Dodd has got a really unhealthy interest in children. They see assorted photographs of children in newspaper clippings and store catalogue underwear advertisements. He's got all of this material that to any normal, well-adjusted human being means nothing. But if you're a child sexual predator, you can kind of find sexual content in the most innocent of places. Also, they notice a torture rack that he's assembling. So he's basically in the process of constructing it, which means that we know he's got some very violent intentions that he's intending to carry out down the line. They know his bed, it's got restraints tied to it. So it's a torture chamber, so to speak. Harrowing for anybody to know, but to even imagine that we're talking about children being harmed in this case takes it to a whole different level. They also find, in spite of this evidence that clearly indicates there's an issue, that there's direct evidence linking him to the crimes. However, in spite of this material that is obviously introducing them to the unhealthy appetite he has for children, they're also able to find direct evidence that links him to the crime. So he's got a scrapbook. It's got clippings and newspaper articles about the murders. Then they find in a briefcase the 4-year-old Lee Isley's Ghostbusters underpants. So Dodd's kept them as this macabre trophy. And then on top of that, even worse, they find a photo album and it contains pictures of Lee. This is before and during and after the horrific sexual torture, after his death even. And there's pictures of him hanging in a closet that he'd photographed. They also found photos that suggested there'd been sexual abuse post-mortem. So this is just beyond what they imagined they were dealing with. And if all this was not incriminating enough, investigators also find a diary, and it is absolutely shocking reading. But it would also create a full picture of Dodd's twisted character, because this guy, he had documented so many of the sexual offences against kids. That was from when he was a teenager right up until the present day. It was very detailed. It was very, very disturbing. I've read it. It's one of the most distressing things I think my eyes have ever witnessed. So he'd started writing it soon after his first killings, and they were basically reflections on his lengthy offending history. It was effectively a journal of a serious child sex offender, and it literally documents his progression over the years as a child molester. It's chilling to read how Dodd's developed into this violent offender, it really is. According to his diary, Dodd's 9 when he starts to acknowledge that he has these sexual feelings towards other children, mainly boys, and he starts with sexual experimentation, talks about playing with a 9-year-old cousin and his friend, and that his cousin and his friend wanted to show Dodd something. And then they touched the penises together, so then Dodd did the same. Now, this obviously is a very innocent action, but it feels like from that, this childlike curiosity just develops into something more and more sinister. Dodd also recalls in an incident the same year that really deeply affected him. So his mother asked him to show his aunts the new school clothes that he was wearing. So he had to change his trousers twice in front of them. And he was very traumatized by them seeing him in his underwear. I think a lot of us can relate to those moments where people forget that when you're young, your mind is still very active and you're very intelligent. And adults sometimes ask you to do things that you're really wholly uncomfortable with, but you end up having to do it because they're asking you to, and you don't feel that you've got an option to say no. Even in these terms where it's so innocent, just being asked to get changed, but it's quite embarrassing in those circumstances. And he clearly felt that in that moment. So again, he notes this as being something that affects him. Other extracts talk about an incident with an 8-year-old girl next door. This is when he's 10. Apparently she allegedly instigated it. She takes him somewhere quiet and she exposes herself, but then he does the same. And he felt humiliated by her response. She just turns away and said she'd seen other boys before. So he felt frustrated and he felt rejected. And he said that it's at this moment in time, there's this pivotal change in the way that he sees the world around him, because he thinks that girls are not that safe anymore. So he decides that any future victim, they'll be a boy. He records how from the age of around 13 to 14, he starts exposing himself in his bedroom window. This is to younger children as they're walking by from school. The diary states that he'd target boys in particular, either on their own or in groups. And he would also expose himself to groups of girls, but there had to be some good-looking boys in there too. He notes that he did this approximately 9 times over a 3-month period. And the only reason that he stops is after he exposes himself to a young boy who's walking by his house alone. Now, according to Dodd, the young boy had actually stared and walked slowly by. So at this point, Dodd had assumed that he'd liked it. But later on, that same day, the police call around at his house because there's been a report of a boy exposing himself at the window. His parents thought it wasn't Dodd, it will have been one of Dodd's friends. I mean, why? I've got no idea. But they're like, it won't be our child. Our child will be completely normal. It'll be one of their friends that's done that. As if like your mate's ever going to be like, hey, just going to go and expose myself at your window. Totally normal practice. You just keep playing with whatever you're playing with. But that's what they believed. So after this, Dodd thinks, you know, it's going to be too risky doing this at home. So he decides to take himself on the road, so to speak. And very soon he earns himself a bit of a reputation for just riding around on his bike and exposing himself to children. Now, his ideal targets are around 6 to 7 years of age. He did this on his bike by riding around wearing no underwear, and he had his genitals hanging from his trousers, and then he had a t-shirt pulled down, and that meant that he could expose himself when the right moment came. Shockingly, his father knew about this behaviour. and didn't think it was an issue. Thought his kid was generally a good kid. My kid, generally a good kid. I mean, he's a sexual predator, but apart from the sexual predator bit, he's a great kid. He's a great kid. Nothing to worry about here. Isn't your kid the one riding around exposing his genitals to minors? He's a good kid. That's all I'm saying. He thought, as a parent, that because he wasn't into drink or drugs, that he was going to be all right. Like, that's even in the same ballpark of criminality. So he just turns the blind eye. And again, what does this do? It reinforces behaviour. Also, how Dodd did not get knocked off that bike by a very angry parent, I do not know. So we now have this incredibly confident Dodd. Now, soon, what he referred to as category one, which means exposing himself, it didn't satisfy him. So he moved on to category two. Let's involve children touching him. And his diary describes attempts to do this with the children that he encountered. He comes up with games such as the guessing game. And this is where he gets the neighborhood children to close their eyes and he puts things in their hand bit by bit, you know, a pencil, pen, so on and so forth. And they've got to guess them. But this starting with a rock or, you know, something from the household that a kid has to describe ultimately ends up with him placing his penis onto their hands. At this point, he's 15 years of age. His kids that he's abusing are 7. So a real power dynamic here. He's really, really in control. He's twice the age, far more mature and far more aware of the world around him. So he knows how to go for very vulnerable kids. The diary then goes on to talk about how he graduates a little and starts getting kids to get involved with guessing games. He gets a group of kids, tells them that they need to expose themselves and that he's going to expose himself. And when it gets to the youngest girl who has to do it, she just runs away. So Dodd runs after her, pins her down and actually starts to remove her clothes. The only time that he stops is when she starts crying. Now, this is when Dodd has a flick of a switch. He starts wanting to use force in the offences. He doesn't like being stopped. So because she cries and it ends the attack, he goes away and thinks, no, I'm not doing it this way anymore. I'm not going to accept no for an answer. By the time Dodd started high school, according to his diary, he was molesting multiple children all over the area on a regular basis. His ideal victims were those he had best access to, easiest access to. So they were his family members, included his 9-year-old cousin. He actually began molesting her when he was 15. He also managed to persuade his 8-year-old cousin to put his penis in his mouth. Other kids were those in the neighborhood. And of course, they were so young that they didn't really know what was going on. A lot of the time, they just saw it as a game. Again, according to his diary, he gets to 16 years of age and begins to babysit a neighbor's children. 6-year-old boy, 3-year-old little girl, and a 1-year-old boy. The diary describes him building up, knowing that he's going to abuse these children, so he's planning it. He opts at that moment in time when he's babysitting not to molest the baby. He thinks that I'm going to get found out because I won't be able to put the nappy back on properly. But he did molest the 3-year-old girl. He believed that when he was doing it, she was actually asleep at the time. But the following day, apparently, allegedly, she'd attempted to put her hand down his pants. It was when he wasn't expecting it and it was in the view of other people. So he was scared that somebody could have seen. But he also notes that he wished that she'd tried it when he was in private, because that's kind of a fantasy for him, isn't it? That this little girl would want it. And again, is testament to how distorted his perspectives are around his actions, full stop. Dodd also claims in his diary that had it not been for him joining the Navy at 20, he would have killed that year. He said that put a blocker on his behaviour. Now, he didn't kill anyone at that time, but he did molest lots of children whilst he was at that naval base where he was stationed. And as I noted earlier on, when he was ultimately caught molesting a child, he managed to avoid severe punishment. You know, that dishonourable discharge did nothing more than give him a slap on the wrist. All he needed to do was attend counselling. So you have to wonder how many times someone can get caught molesting children before firm action is taken. laws meant to protect the most vulnerable in society, but it's like you can't get more vulnerable than children, yet time after time, a repeat sex offender who displays a pattern of even more serious offending is barely punished. So it shows the manipulation of an individual like Dodd. He was obviously believable. He could act polite, respectful, when in truth, he was an absolute monster. And Dodd designed his entire life around his offending behavior. So moved into an apartment block, specifically because it housed families with children. Worked at places frequented by families, so fast food restaurants, charity truck driver. It was low paid work, but money was not important to him. His interests lay in the abuse that he liked to carry out. We get to 1985, and Dodd, who's 24 then, puts an entry in his diary saying that his new neighbours have moved in. It's a woman with two young children, a two-year-old and a four-year-old boy. Now, Dodd's molesting them pretty much from the get-go. The mother finds out, and she is absolutely horrified, but she decides that she's not going to press charges because she doesn't want to traumatise her kids any further. Now, again, this is an opportunity where Dodd's serious behaviour and offending could have been addressed, but it was missed. And again, it means that he doesn't feel that his actions deserve any consequences to some degree. For investigators reading this diary, it's absolutely terrifying. But even worse was to follow, because as Dodd had said, there'd be incriminating evidence in his apartment, and they'd found some. But reading this diary, they noted graphic details regarding the murder of Billy and Colnier and Lee Izzerly. So autumn 1989, by this time Dodd is 28 and he documents the best place for R&M, which are obviously indicative of rape and murder. He identifies the ideal location, Vancouver's David Douglas Park. It's a heavily wooded area with secluded trails. Over the course of several days, he goes there for hours at a time, just waiting for the right opportunity. And on the 4th of September 1989, Dodd's diary entry states that he goes to Douglas Park. He's armed with a fish filleting knife. He's gone out with a weapon before, but this time he's strapped it to his ankle with an elasticated bandage. Also, he recalled that it got long shoelaces in his pocket. 6:19 p.m. Dodd approaches two young boys on bikes. That's 10-year-old Billy and 11-year-old Colnier. He said, "I want you to come with me." The older boy asks why. Dodd replied, "Because I told you to. You can bring your bikes if you want." He didn't want someone to find the bikes and to start looking for the boys. Then he walked them 5 minutes to the most isolated part of the park. They actually passed two teenagers on the way, and Dodd warned the boys not to talk to them. He left the bikes on the path, then he takes them to the trees and the bushes. He stood them back to back, ties their wrists together tightly with laces. The diary then described the sexual assault that Dodd subjected Cole to, included attempted rape. So after almost 20 minutes, the boys think they're going to be released. But then Dodd says, "Just one more thing." Then he takes the knife from his ankle strap. He first stabbed Billy in his stomach. He expected Billy to drop, but he doesn't. He grabs his stomach and he starts to run. Dodd then stabs Cole 3 times, including in the chest. Then he runs after Billy. And he catches him by his right arm and then he stabs him in his lower side. And as Billy spins round, he says, I'm sorry. It's just awful to imagine that child apologising, not knowing what's happening, thinking, what on earth have I done wrong? Why is this person doing this? And just saying sorry, because he can't compute. He then gets stabbed again in the left shoulder. Dodd then runs to the path and he starts walking. But after 30 yards, he stops and he runs back because he wants to make sure he hasn't left any evidence behind. He sees Cole flat on his back, head tilted to the left, eyes still open, arms at the side, and he knows he's definitely dead. He was going to make sure that Billy was dead, but he decides that it's going to take extra time. He doesn't want to take that risk. So instead, he just calmly walks away. Shortly after this, he sees a man just running down the hill. So that man had evidently just discovered the crime scene. Dodd recalls in his diary that he thought he might get caught at that moment. He's relieved that he doesn't. Neil later disposes of the knife in an envelope in a dumpster. Now, he claims that those killings shook him up, said he couldn't get the picture of Cole's body out of his mind, and he couldn't stop hearing Billy saying, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry." But years later, he claims to have masturbated multiple times whilst picturing Cole's dead body. So again, I don't think he was torn up by it at all. I just think he learned to say the right things in the right places to the right people. Simple as that. The diary makes it clear that after Dodd's first experience of killing, he wants more. But he has a problem, and that problem is he doesn't want it to end as quickly. He wants to take his time. He doesn't want to be rushed. He wants to abduct a child. He wants to murder a child, but he wants to be able to play out the darkest fantasies that he has in his mind, and he needs space and time to do so. So he decides that he wants to bring a child back to his apartment. That way he could truly fulfill his ultimate fantasies, the sexual torture, the rape, and the murder of a child. Also, he describes that he wants to fulfill another fantasy, which is to have sex with the dead body. He wants to purchase a cassette recorder so that he can tape the sexual torture. He even talks about the possibility of consuming the victim's genitals. He also documents how a knife is best for first kills. It needs to be quick because you're in a public location and you don't want people finding you. So he expressed that the next time he killed, he wanted it to be clean. So he wants the body to be clean for post-mortem penetration. And also he noticed he wants it to be quiet, whereas raping a child in his apartment might not be quiet because they might make noise. So he needs the victim dead. So he goes on to write about the fact that he feels that kidnapping's the best option because it's going to give you more opportunity to molest the victim and you don't need to kill them quickly. And he could also use something other than a knife. The diary entry for the 29th of October 1989 recalls that Dodd drives to Portland, Oregon, and he goes hunting at a local park. He spots a young boy. This little boy is playing alone on a slide. That little boy later turns out to be 4-year-old Lee Isley. He was there with his 9-year-old brother, Justin. So Dodd waits until the older boy's left, and then he approaches Lee. He asks Lee if he wants to have some fun, to make some money. Lee seems really unsure, but he's not scared, he's 4. Why would he be scared of a grown-up? Probably hasn't ever encountered any malevolent grown-ups. Dodd says, "Come on, this will be fun." And he takes his hand and he walks him to the car. And Lee tells him, "I don't want any money." Dodd picks him up and says, "We're still going. Let's go ask your dad if you can go with me." He got in the car and he drove away. And Lee said, "I live the other way." Dodd replied, "We're going to go to my house to play some games. Just do what I tell you and I promise I won't hurt you." Somehow Dodd managed to walk that little 4-year-old into his apartment unseen. Diary then documents what Dodd subjected this 4-year-old to. It's too horrific to talk about in detail here. I'm not going to do that because I've read the diary and it is absolutely horrific. But Lee endured a day of sexual torture and rape before Dodd finally killed him. He also took photographs throughout the abuse and he finally choked him on multiple occasions. He allowed him to be revived again and then he'd choke him again. Just how that human being could do that to that little child is beyond my comprehension. Just demonstrates how sadistic Dodd is. Ultimately, he began strangling him with a rope on the bed and then he took the rope. He tied it to a clothes rail in the wardrobe and he hanged him there for 10 minutes and then photographed his body. And then he documented his sexual activity with the boy's corpse. It's all there in the diary. The following day, Dodd tries to get rid of evidence and he burns Lee's clothes. But as we know, he kept his underwear as a trophy. Now, Dodd would later go on to tell police that he hadn't originally planned to kill Lee, but then he decided that he didn't want to leave a witness. So he stuffed Lee's naked body in rubbish bags and then just dumps him like trash in some bushes near Vancouver Lake. After Lee's body was found, Dodd had decided that he needed to keep a bit of a low profile. So he mostly stayed in his apartment during this time. So it's here he decides to continue with these fantasies and he starts writing about his plans to do further abductions, further murders. And he also spends time perfecting this homemade torture rack because he wants it ready for his next victim. Now, Dodd's diary entries, well, they abruptly end on the 13th of November 1989. This is following his arrest at the cinema in Camas. This is when he tried, as I've said, to abduct six-year-old James Kirk. But the diary evidence, the fact that he had been visiting cinemas multiple times during previous days looking for a victim. One of the final entries, the afternoon before he was apprehended, actually stated this: "I now ask Satan to guide me and provide or help me obtain a boy tonight. This one I'd like to keep a while, keeping him awake all night, each night, so he'll sleep all day while I'm at work, tied and mouth taped shut to be on the safe side. I may only keep him 2 or 3 days, or even longer if it worked out." You can see, can't you? This is a man who genuinely believes that he's going to be able to carry out these crimes for as long as he wishes to. This is an individual who has got no consequential understanding because he's been given very few consequences. And also, when you read the diary, and like I said, I'm not suggesting or encouraging that you do, because it is harrowing, you'll also note sometimes the language shifts. So at times he'll refer to the boys by their names, then he might use he or she if it's a female or a male, but then at times he refers to his victims as it. So it is a complete dehumanization. They're not human beings, they're objects at that moment in time. So it is interesting how his language changes and shifts during the diary entries. Now, following the search of his apartment, obviously the police have him banged to rights. So Dodd's charged with aggravated first degree murder in the deaths of Billy and Cole Near and Lee Isley, plus the attempted kidnapping and murder of James Kirk, which, thank God, James Kirk was not abducted, because we all know what lay in store for him at that apartment. We know about the torture rack. We know he was going to keep him for days, and we know exactly how this would have ended. That little boy, that sliding doors moment, my God, how things could have been different. Now, initially, Dodd does admit to everything. He says, "Yeah, I've been involved with child sexual molestation, abuse and murder for decades. It began when I started to expose myself and it became inappropriate touching. Then it graduated to rape and ultimately murder." And they were able to identify around 50 of his victims. All of those were below the age of 12, the youngest of which was just 2 years of age. This guy is a monster. However, Dodd also estimated that even though they'd been able to turn up 50 victims, when it came down to the sex offences against children, he'd committed at least 175, 20 of which were contact crimes, i.e. he sexually molested them. And he said that those victims in particular, it happened over a period of months, so there were multiple occasions of abuse. Dodd also confessed to the murders of 10-year-old Billy and his brother 11-year-old Cole Near. He also admitted the abduction, rape and murder of 4-year-old Lee Isley. And there was overwhelming evidence, so it makes sense that he said that he was guilty, because literally he had documented the killings in a diary and had photographic evidence of the killings at his place of residence. So he has to say that he's guilty. Maybe he thought that if he did that, he'd get an early guilty plea deal, maybe avoid the death sentence. But unbelievably, in spite of what I've just said to you, he then just tries to retract his confession. It's like, I don't know, maybe I didn't do it. Well, we have everything that says that you did do it, including photographs in your house. But did I do it? Well, I mean, you said you did it specifically. We've got recordings of you saying that you did it. But did I do it? Well, yeah, because you admitted it. The diary entries literally tallying with the crimes, and there's photographs of the victims. But did I do it? So anyway, this is what he does, and he argues that the evidence that was found in the apartment had basically been taken illegally. I mean, that's just insane, isn't it? Could you imagine if there was some kind of loophole in this moment of time where the investigators are like, oh my God, we did it illegally, therefore we can't enter any of the evidence, that evidences that we've got a serial killer and child killer on our hands, couldn't have been taken into court. and they'd have walked away. Wouldn't that have been crazy? So thankfully, he's completely unsuccessful. Now, at the trial, Dodd finally enters guilty pleas to all charges. He didn't testify, nor did the defence even call any witnesses. There was no reason to, because he's clearly massively guilty. All they tried to do is argue that Dodd was insane, which he clearly wasn't, because he knew exactly what he was doing. And the prosecution, they read harrowing extracts from Dodd's diary, and the jury had to sit and witness photos of Lee and the abuse that he suffered and his murder, and they had to actually hear those diary entries, which, believe me, are incredibly graphic, as I've said. The jury ultimately found him guilty on all counts, and they also concluded that the nature of the offences were so grave, so diabolical, that he indeed deserved the death penalty. Now, Dodd at this point is offered a choice of execution, hanging or lethal injection. Now, he stated at that point that the reason that he was going to select hanging was because he'd hanged Lee easily, and it was only fitting and right that he himself chose to go in a way that he had taken the life of his victims in. Now, only Washington, Delaware, and Montana allowed hanging as an option, even though it was an option with respect, because it's not that palatable. It hadn't actually been used as a form of capital punishment in the US since 1965. But Dodd requested it. And because of that, he was allowed to select that particular type of execution for his own death. So in 1990, he gets sentenced to death by hanging. And he's sent to death row in Walla Walla, Washington. Now, civil liberty groups actually campaigned on his behalf to prevent his execution, which is ironic, because Dodd didn't want them to. Dodd was like, I want to die. And they were like, we don't want you to die, but I want to die. We don't want you to die. Stop making me not die when I want to die. We're a civil liberty group. We want to look after your freedom and your freedom of liberty. Am I not at liberty to choose to die? Well, that makes sense, but then it would go against what we're trying to do. None of this makes sense. Just let me die. Anyway, that's what they're doing. He says he definitely wants to die and says that anybody who tries to prevent his death would basically be a co-conspirator in his next crime. See what he did there? That was pretty impressive, making the civil liberty group people think twice about whether they should indeed save him for fear that he actually would continue on some kind of rampage of crime that they would then be culpable for because they hadn't let him die. Now, in the US, when a convict is sentenced to death, there's an automatic right of appeal of that death sentence, because obviously once it's carried out, there's no going back. So they need to be absolutely sure that it's the right decision. However, Dodd requested that the review process didn't take place. He said he wanted to be executed as quickly as possible. Many of you who are into true crime will know that in America, convicts often spend decades on death row, exhausting appeals and going through all the motions so that they get to live longer. They try anything to spare their lives, but Dodd did the exact opposite. So his execution was ultimately carried out just 4 years after his conviction. On the 5th of January 1993, he was 31 years of age at the time. Interestingly, whilst on death row, Dodd had allegedly found Jesus. When, I don't know why I did it in that voice then, but I'm imagining an enlightening moment for him. So when asked if he had any last words, he stated the following. I was once asked by somebody, I don't remember who, if there was any way sex offenders could be stopped. I said no. I was wrong. I was wrong when I said there was no hope, no peace. There is hope. There is peace. I found both in the Lord Jesus Christ. Look to the Lord and you will find peace. I'm going to throw it out there, Dodd. I know women who believe that Jesus and all of those kind of religious deities are really forgiving, but I don't think he will be. I think that the big G-O-D will be like, well, nice try, Dodd. I'm glad you found a little bit of peace before you died, but I'm afraid it's still the elevator down, 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 to eternal hell and damnation and burning. Now, Dodd was the 185th person put to death in the US since the resumption of legal executions in the country. The first was Gary Gilmore. He was shot by Utah firing squad in 1977. Gilmore had demanded state execution after admitting to two murders. He became the first person in almost 10 years to be executed in the US. It had before been considered a cruel and unusual punishment, and therefore it was seen as unconstitutional. Now, it's unclear what Dodd's motivation was in bringing forward his execution, because there are lots of conflicting reports. So in some it says he felt some remorse. So he often thought about what the last things his victims did and said, and therefore it preyed on his mind, and he believed that he needed to make amends by giving his life. Also, he stated that his execution was actually the only way that he could ever be able to keep children safe, because he made it absolutely clear that if he escaped or if he was ever released, he would definitely kill again. In fact, he said, "I must be executed before I have an opportunity to escape or kill someone else. If I do escape, I promise you, I will kill and rape again, and I will enjoy every minute of it." I mean, again, why the civil liberties groups campaigning for people like this? Who knows?
What would be your intention if you're forced to live in prison?
Do everything I can to escape, and if necessary, kill prison guards on the way out. And I'll go right back to doing what I did before as soon as I hit the streets.
Which is what?
Kill kids.
However, in spite of the fact that he's tried to play this idea out that he's got some kind of remorse in this, I don't believe it for one minute. I genuinely think the reason he wanted to be put to death and the reason that he controlled how he was put to death was because he didn't want to spend the rest of his life in prison. He had particular predilections and delights in his head, fantasy-wise, about the most disgusting of things, and that's what he lived for. He took jobs so that he didn't really have to work hard, so he could concentrate on the things that really motivated him, which was the sexual destruction and murder of children. So he didn't want to spend the rest of his life not having access to do that. So making sure that his life was ended as quickly as possible meant that, firstly, he controlled his end, meaning that he had the power. And secondly, he didn't have to struggle day in and day out, as many prisoners do, knowing they'll never be free. When you look at Dodd, you can see he was a lust killer. But also, a medical expert diagnosed him as a sexual psychopath. He meets the criteria without a doubt. But Dodd is definitely a power control killer as well. His victims were all children. So because he was older, they followed his commands. He was always in a position of authority, and he enjoyed the power he had over his victims. He was older, bigger, stronger. He used to use his victims and he disposed of them like rubbish. Isn't it interesting as well that the one time he was actually faced with someone his own size, when he tried to abduct that little boy from the cinema, wow, he was apprehended immediately. So, wasn't really very strong when confronted with somebody who was actually his size. Like I've said, this is why I genuinely believe that he controlled his ending. He wanted to be put to death because he didn't want to be in the general population of the prison, being the kind of child killer that he was, locked up for the rest of his days without parole. You know, a lot of guys in there don't like child killers, don't like child rapists. Can't imagine that the rest of his life would have been that pleasant, can you? So, arguably, he got away easy. I genuinely believe that this man got off scot-free as far as I'm concerned when it comes down to what he deserved. It's incredible to think about the number of offences that Dodd committed, the number of times that he was convicted of sex offences against kids. No one took the warning signs seriously. He was just given minor sentences, just go to counselling, it'll be fine. But because of this, he never had to take it seriously. In fact, Dodd stated this, "Each time we entered treatment, I continued to molest kids. I liked molesting children and did what I had to do to avoid jail so I could continue molesting." It's incredible when you consider what I've talked about today. The escalation in criminality that we see, the opportunities for authorities to intervene, the reinforcement of confidence when they failed to give him appropriate sentences for his offending, and the reality of what this led to. Dodd received minor punishments, and because of this, he was able to satisfy even more violent fantasies in spite of this long history of assaulting children. You know, Dodd, until he was incarcerated fully and finally, he never spent more than 4 months in jail at any one time. Also, when he was in prison, this is really strange, he decided that he was gonna create a pamphlet that was all about protecting children from being caught by paedophiles, like a manual as to how to avoid being a victim. And this is all based on his own experiences, including his own capture. And the reason he did this is he said he wanted to do what he could whilst he could to help kids. So the pamphlet basically encouraged children to not be compliant. Instead, he said they should be a hero. Say no, shout and scream and struggle. And in the pamphlet, the hero is this six-year-old boy who obviously has been designed around the experience of him trying to abduct James Kirk. In fact, the child bears a resemblance in the pamphlet to James Kirk. And it states, he knew he couldn't get away, but he didn't give up. He started screaming and yelled, "Someone help me, he's killing me." He kept screaming and yelling. I was afraid someone would hear him, so I let him go and ran away. The boy ran and told someone what happened, and the police caught me 10 minutes later. He's a hero now. Be a hero. The pamphlet contained advice including, just say no. I met a boy at a park, I told him to pull down his pants, he said no. I told him he couldn't leave until he did. He said no again. I made him promise not to tell anyone what happened and let him go. He didn't pull his pants down. Run. Another boy said no. Then before I could make him do what I wanted anyway, he ran away. I ran away too. I went the other way. Just remember, just say no, run, scream, yell, get away, tell someone, be a hero. I mean, genuinely, he really wrote this inside. Just get your heads around that. This mass child murderer trying to create an advisory pamphlet for children who may meet somebody like him. Ironically, some of what he says though does make sense in spite of the fact that it's so warped. Now, a chilling final note here. Dodd may be dead, but his younger brother Gregory was arrested in 2016 for attempted sexual abuse of a 13-year-old girl. Ooh, is it in the genes, eh? Is it in the genes? Now, whether you agree or otherwise, guys, with capital punishment, can we all agree that the world is a far better place without Wesley Allen Dodd? I mean, there'll be others out there like him, but one less is a positive. We've got to use his crimes as a lesson, haven't we? We've got to take some of the stuff that we've learned from monsters like him to make us realise how careful we need to be with our children. I mean, I'm not talking about wrapping them up in cotton wool. You can't do that. You can't keep an eye on them 24/7. But it's more about educating them. It's more about equipping them with knowledge. It's about helping them to know how to stay safe. And there's one main lesson. It's one of my favourite lessons. Do not comply. Teach your kids, scream, shout, bite, scratch, raise the alarm. Because whilst these monsters are rare, if your child comes across them, you want to make damn sure that they're equipped. You want to make damn sure that they let all hell break loose, because that's how to survive one of these child serial killers. Today's case has been one of those where genuinely I cannot believe I've had to cover, because I cannot believe that human predators like him exist. I'd be really interested in your thoughts. A lot of you may not have heard of this person. And like I said, I didn't go into graphic detail about the diary because it's pretty triggering. But for those of you who want to, you can find it out there. It's horrific. It's horrific. I'm not going to lie. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.